Welcome to Primary Viewpoints from Patient Care Online, a monthly podcast that features informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about what impacts primary care medicine today. I'm your host, Cindy Jennings, Associate Editor with Patient Care Online. In this episode, our senior editor, Grace Halsey, talks with Dr. Ani Nalbandian, a cardiology fellow at Columbia University Vagelos School of Medicine, who recently spearheaded a comprehensive review of the literature accumulating on long COVID-19. What were the findings? Let's dive in.
So to get started, could you give us some background on how the plan for the review came into being? I mean, we don't have water cooler conversations anymore. And I know that a number of your co-authors are in cities that were extremely hard hit by the first wave of COVID.
Absolutely. It was very organic. Many of us, as you pointed out, in New York City and in Boston were, you know, really in the throes of COVID last spring. You know, as a cardiology fellow, we were deployed to the ICUs, and we were, all the ICUs became COVID ICUs, you know, independent of neuro ICU, surgical ICU. They were all full of COVID patients with severe acute respiratory distress syndrome and multi-organ failure related to that. So it was not unexpected. And for many of us within cardiology as well, you know, we have a lot of our training is within critical care as well, particularly at Columbia. And so we have a lot of exposure to patients who we will then see having the sequela of critical illness. And so many of us realize that this was in the summer months when the first wave was sort of waning, but we knew that there would be further waves. But then is when we began to see our patients who were, you know, COVID survivors and, you know, past the couple months out or maybe reaching 2-3 months out of infection. And so one, we expected that we would see patients with sequela of infection, but also anecdotally, it was coming up in clinic, patients who were complaining of, you know, ongoing vague symptoms and had had COVID infection, sometimes not so vague symptoms. Mm. And so it was both what the patients were also telling us, as well as not just in our clinics, but what's so novel about this pandemic is the role that social media has played in it, I think, because there's immediate dissemination of information, both from physician, healthcare provider to the patients, but from patients also voicing what they're feeling as well. And a mass level. And so that's how it came about. The recognition that there were going to be lingering effects based off of patients with critical illness, but also then hearing and seeing patients in clinic.
So in the paper, you define post-COVID-19 and then you subdivide the definition. Could you give us the definition and the two categories?
Certainly. I'd also like to point out, I mean, with regards to definition, that's something that is not yet fixed. You know, this is reflective of how the medical society is viewing, you know, COVID acute infection, subacute infection, and then chronic infection at this moment in time. So in the literature, there were different cutoff points, some saying about 3 weeks, some 4 weeks. And that's largely probably dependent on the information that was available at the time. So in general, though, you know, speaking about when we think about an acute illness versus a subacute illness, it's usually acute happening at that moment and subacute several weeks later. So for the purposes of this paper, based on the literature, the data in the literature, we use 4 weeks as sort of the cutoff then from after the acute infection, and then beyond 4 weeks, you know, in the 12 weeks and to be more chronic. That may shift over time, but I think that's pretty generalizable right now.
So you already mentioned the considerable overlap between hospitalization for critical, I mean, the aftermath of hospitalization for critical illness. We saw similar symptoms after the SARS outbreak in 2003. People have compared the aftermath to what was seen after Ebola. Are there features of SARS-CoV-2 post-acute infection or chronic infection that are considerably different from those?
Mm-hmm. That's a really great question. I think that the scope of the pandemic now is allowing us to be better detectives, meaning we have more, our N number, right? The total number of people or patients affected is greater than occurred with the prior SARS and MERS. And so when you have more of a population, the chances that you're going to pick up a signal from that population will be more amplified than if you have a smaller population. What I mean to say is, whether or not this is definitively unique to COVID or to SARS-CoV-2, that this is much more vicious is possible. And certainly in the acute setting, it behaves that way. But whether that's distinctly unique to the virus itself versus just we're seeing more of it. And, for that reason, is it more prevalent? Is that what I mean to say? There were a few studies that we had cited within our paper, or referenced within our paper rather, in the introduction, alluding to the prior SARS and MERS. And those studies, were looking several years out at patients. Again, the total number of patients is going to be far less than what we will be having with COVID. But yes, certain patients might have symptoms, ongoing shortness of breath, but with COVID, it just seems so much more robust.
And are there some symptoms, though, that seem pretty different? I mean, ongoing loss of taste, loss of smell. Are there specific categories that we haven't seen before that seem to linger?
Yes, I to my knowledge, the loss of taste and smell and brain fog seem to stand out more. I don't know definitively if those have never been seen in any of the patients with SARS or MERS in the long term. So I don't want to mislead on that. But the loss of taste and smell and the sort of brain fog seems to be prevalent with COVID. What's interesting too is that it's not just patients with severe critical illness who are recovering, right? It's patients who might have had mild to moderate infection, or just a very, they recuperated at home, but then still have symptoms. So that's what's striking, is it's not that direct correlation that one might expect with the severity of acute illness and then ongoing symptoms or the duration of symptoms. So, that's why I think it's so important for all of us within healthcare to keep an open mind when we're seeing patients in clinic or any interaction, because it's not a one-to-one correlation.
Sure. And something else that seems different, I don't know, you can correct me, is that sometimes these symptoms don't appear immediately post-infection. Some people are going along fine 3 weeks after they, even if they took care of themselves at home, and then brain fog sets in or muscle cramps set in. And I don't know if we saw that with any of the others. Again, time may tell, but is there any thought for how that might be happening?
Yes. So what we encountered when we were, as we were preparing this review paper and going through the data ourselves, was, and it was a really fascinating process, because a few times, I think, is one going to be in the midst of a pandemic like this, and the literature is evolving week to week, almost day by day. So we first set out embarked on this in the summer months, around July, August. And at that time, again, it was probably more anecdotal of what we were observing rather than the data that we could cite. And then as we progressed and the months went by, by November or so, a lot of these studies had been published. And so week by week, there's more information. And it's not just the observational data, but it's also, we need time to be able to do the basic science analysis, meaning, doing the autopsy studies and actually seeing, is there virus still within tissue? And just because then you have the presence of virus, does that necessarily mean that there's the effects of that virus still on that organ system, right? So that's one big component of it, which time will help tell, and more data. But the other thing is, of course, how do we tease out just the sort of post-inflammatory milieu that happens in patients, and can sort of the fatigue, these are all very non-specific symptoms, fatigue, muscle ache, that's hard to tease apart from just having been ill and recuperating. And then, of course, you have to then look at all the subcategories of patients. Do they have other chronic comorbidities? Is this just a pristine patient who doesn't have, arthralgias at baseline? So it makes it quite complex. But what you point out is good. That is a good point, in that patients, maybe it's also that, you know, when they initially were sick, their shortness of breath was the main symptom that they were really focused on or that was bothering them. And then as that improves, perhaps then it's, and they start to exert themselves more, then it becomes, you know, the fatigue or the muscle cramps or so forth. That's so true. I think that's all the information and the perspective that we have to keep in mind. Having spent a lot of time looking at the literature and being invested in this topic, I think we have to all really contribute further to clinical observations and data collection. You know, not everything is necessarily COVID is what I mean to say.
Sure.
it's walking that fine line of recognizing, but not dismissing other things that it could also be.
I wanted to ask about disparities in distribution of long COVID symptoms. Did the literature reveal similar inequities that we've seen in the disease itself and in the care for the disease?
In the long-term setting, I think that also remains to be better assessed with objective data. You know, there wasn't that much robust data to say in these subgroups of patients that they have an increased risk of the persistence of symptoms, you know, to definitively say that. But I think that people are perhaps extrapolating that if, you know, there are patients who the initial population is going to be, have a lot more racial disparity than subsequent to that, that, you know, the chronic population, that might very well be the case. There have been some reports of what's called COVAN, like COVID-associated nephropathy. But this is something that's also very much in development in looking through the literature and speaking with our nephrologists. You know, we have to, is that specific to only people of a certain race and a certain genetic background? There are some conjectures, but I think there also needs to be a little bit more definitive data about that. That being said, if patients don't have, you know, well, very routine follow-up, then, you know, it's only logical that then we can expect that they're maybe not going to be able to recover as quickly or if they don't have those resources.
Sure.
And so then something that might be an acute recoverable illness might become chronic in that sense.
Going back to something you said earlier about not everything is COVID, I read a quote from one of your, I guess just the senior author, Dr. Elaine Wan, who said, no matter what the patient comes in for, I now ask if they ever had COVID-19 infection. And I know that she's an electrophysiologist and she's a cardiology, but it made me start thinking about primary care, where people go to their doctor with vague symptoms all the time. How can we help guide this frontline group of practitioners who are also dealing with maybe the vague symptoms of acute infection as well as this aftermath? What should they be on the lookout for and what should their mindset be?
That's a terrific question and not an easy one because primary care physicians and physicians in general, you know, there's always that time factor. Being able to have the quantity and the quality of time to spend with patients to do a thorough review of systems and ask. And that's one of the big challenges in medicine is if you don't ask the right questions, then you might not uncover what's actually going on with the patient. Sometimes you uncover the points, but you have to connect the dots. But I think that for in general, in very sort of concrete bullet points, so if a patient has had, it's easier to answer in my mind for those who've actually been, let's say, hospitalized, because there's some narrative to what happened to them, presumably while they were hospitalized, right? In that discharge summary and that information that we get from the hospital. If they had a severe hypoxemia, an oxygen requirement, if they needed to be intubated, absolutely they should be following up on their lung function capacity, either with PFTs or having them referred to a pulmonologist, at least initially, to make sure that there isn't residual effect. Imaging findings can also be helpful. There are studies that have been showing that there may be some degree of fibrotic changes that may persist at several months out. But that is, you know, and probably that's one of the easiest things to screen for. You know, shortness of breath, is it at rest? Is it with exercise? Has there been a change from the patient's baseline prior to when they had a COVID-19 infection? Functional capacity, independent of if a patient had severe COVID illness and or asymptomatic illness, just maybe assessing for that. If they had any degree of heart disease or heart complications, meaning any arrhythmias while they were hospitalized, or if when during their infection they were really feeling these palpitations, it wouldn't be inappropriate to check, have them wear a monitor, at least get an EKG to start off. If they had what we call heart failure, either due to, you know, the being septic at the time and or stress cardiomyopathy and or viral cardiomyopathy, they should certainly have follow-up and sort of the typical review of systems questions that we ask for to assess for heart failure and in a focused exam to assess for that as well. If they had a reduced ejection fraction and on their echo at the time of hospitalization with COVID-19 infection, you know, after a period of time, they should have repeat echo as well. And then that would also certainly be a trigger to say, this patient needs to see a cardiologist. So those are sort of by organ system. If they had any, if they needed intubation for and sedation for a prolonged period of time, that in and of itself may be a reason that they might have some residual cognitive or sort of a slowing that can occur. And then COVID on top of it has certainly been another exacerbating factor. So perhaps that patient might need to have a more thorough neurologic assessment. And I think all patients should have a depression screen if they're able to, you know, meaning perhaps they're sitting out in the waiting area and they can fill out the PHQ-9 right. Or a GAD, and it's simple and easy enough, and then have that ready. Probably that's true in general as primary care physicians have right. that, but it's all the more important now, especially even if a patient hasn't had COVID, all of our lives in some way have been severely affected by this. For the patients who have had sort of unmasking of diabetes, if this is, again, speaking to the inpatient side during, let's say, if they were critically ill, then that might warrant just a closer eye to checking in a hemoglobin A1C and seeing is there persistent hyperglycemia. And if so, then I think that's sort of a sign to be a little bit more focused in on that and following up on that. In rare instances, but it has been reported about adrenal insufficiency in patients, but that's more on the rare. So the main things I think are with regards to the pulmonary, also renal. That's very, very, very important. So interestingly, we all know, I mean, the patients who obviously end up needing renal replacement therapy as inpatients and then go on to need dialysis, those are clearly going to have nephrology follow-up. But there are patients who might have AKI, acute kidney injury, during the time of infection, and or, you know, just their creatinine, their renal function doesn't settle back out to what their baseline was. They should continue to have a serial follow-up of their renal function. It shouldn't be thought that they will necessarily normalize. They might end up having, you know, sort of a conversion to maybe chronic kidney disease. Mm-hmm. So a closer eye to that as well, certainly.
What was the most rewarding part of this whole experience for you? I mean, it's clear that it was fascinating. And what you said earlier about being in the middle of a pandemic with piles of data all around you in the moment sounds pretty wonderful, I guess.
It was very eye-opening and very instructive to me in the sense that I would always like sort of pause and think, my goodness, just a few months ago, we didn't know this. And even, you know, a year ago, at the time when we had started this paper, this was a fantastical thing that nobody would have ever fathomed. But then to see how the world is sort of coming together and how scientists and physicians are robustly churning out this information, it always sort of warmed my heart to when I'd go to a PubMed link and then the article is, you know, free access to download. I mean, that's not a problem for us in the university, but in general, sure. Just in other words, how important it is that we get information out, that everybody's doing their part. That was unique. I mean, I don't know if there are so many other fields outside of medicine where you have that, everybody contributing and coming together in that sense. Similarly, you know, with regards to my co-authors, really enjoyed working with all of them, mm-hmm. each with their own keen eye to the literature, to what they were seeing with their patients, to the feedback. How can we make this relevant both to, you know, specialists, but also generalizable to physicians, to healthcare providers, and also to the patients? So everybody chipped in, and everybody really saw the importance of this and the timeliness of it. Those were certainly rewarding features for me.